Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be back here at home, sort of, at the Fields Institute. It's appropriate to follow, but a little intimidating to be following Mike Mackey on this platform. As I've already mentioned, I'm relative newcomer to mathematical biology. In fact, I never took a biology course in my life, so I apologize to the biological and medical experts in the audience for my naivete in this area. However, it's large. Oh, and I have some reprints here if anyone's interested after the talk to learn more about this work. It's appropriate, though, as I said. Oh, and these are my colleagues, Julie Adamatic and Fang Dong, actually are students at the University of Guelph who worked on this. And Julie has since graduated, and Fang is just starting. She would have been here today, except she had to miss for medical reasons. In a sense, Mike Mackey is the father of this project because he inspired it in a number of ways. I was at McGill in the 70s when he did some of the work he mentioned a few minutes ago, the early work. It was Mackey and Glass who introduced the term dynamical disease. In the 70s, and my paraphrase of their definition, maybe Michael will forgive me, is dynamical disease is a disease that's not caused in the usual sense by a virus or bacteria, but rather is some malfunction in a biological control system. And so to understand this, as Glass and Mackey pointed out, you need to learn some dynamical systems in control theory. And I think they were really pioneers in this approach to dynamical disease. Jacques Belair, who's here, I think, and Glass and others in Montreal organized a workshop on the topic of dynamical disease. It was the first meeting that I know of with that name in 1994, and I attended that, and that was very inspiring for me. I met a lot of medical people and some mathematical people, and came home with a long list of interesting problems to keep me and my students busy. And what I'm talking about today is one of those problems I learned about or got inspired about in 1994. My own field of especially is dynamical systems and especially bifurcation theory. But what is bifurcation theory? Well, you might say it's a general study of qualitative changes in the behavior of a dynamical system that occur when a parameter is varied. For example, steady states may appear or disappear. I mean, that's a real major qualitative change. Change of stable to unstable of a solution. Appearance or disappearance of a limit cycle, which is the Hopf bifurcation. These are sorts of things that bifurcation theory studies, and I think they're what's important in these dynamical diseases, right? By definition, dynamical disease is when some system changes qualitatively the type of behavior, so that's a bifurcation. So my excitement at that workshop in Montreal was in realizing that bifurcation theory would be a useful tool in studying dynamical disease. And so one of the problems there, and which actually goes back much earlier, which, something that Mackey and Glass studied in the 70s, and I remember talking to them about this and other similar problems, is the problem of chain Stokes respiration. So what is chain Stokes respiration? Perhaps not everyone knows about this. It goes back well over 100 years to two guys named Chain and Stokes, as you would guess, medical people. And here is the textbook description from one of the textbooks of medical physiology, not a math book, of what is chain Stokes respiration. So let me take a few minutes to go over this in case there are maybe some mathematicians like me who didn't know about this. The first trace here represents respiration, okay, breathing. In chain Stokes respiration, you get an increase in the amplitude of the breathing. You can think of this up and down as inhale, exhale. And then it peaks in amplitude, decreases, and then it's flat. The individual stops breathing for a while and then begins breathing again to large amplitude and so on. That repeats A period is about a minute, typically in humans, and it occurs in other animals, other mammals as well. So this is what anyone could observe. If your partner has this, then you'll observe this probably while they're sleeping, and can be very worrisome, especially in this portion. If you're the type of person who worries, you wonder if they're going to start again. That, typically they do, fortunately. With more sophisticated instrumentation, you get curves like this. The smooth red curve here is a measure of partial pressure concentration of carbon dioxide in the lungs, the blood in the lungs, okay. The black dashed curve here is the same thing, measure of carbon dioxide in the blood as it reaches what's labeled here as respiratory neurons. Just think of it as the brain, okay. The brain monitors carbon dioxide in the blood. There are sensors that do this, and depending on whether the CO2 is higher or lower than it should be, it sends a message to the lungs to tell them to breathe hard more or less and keep the carbon dioxide in the desirable range. So you notice here that this is time, and they're deliberately drawn so that the carbon dioxide in the lungs is in phase with the large amplitude breathing of the Chain-Stokes phenomenon. The carbon dioxide concentration in the lung is advanced in phase compared to the carbon dioxide concentration in the blood as it reaches the brain. That's simply due to the time lag. So obviously there's a time delay problem. The time lag that it takes for the blood to get from the lungs to the brain is shown by this shift right here. And the lack of a time lag from the peak at the brain and in the lungs is due to the fact your nervous system reacts very quickly. So there's negligible time lag there. So this is in, as I said, a standard medical textbook without a mathematical model or quantitative explanation of it. There's a lot of data on Chain-Stokes respiration in humans. It doesn't normally occur in healthy humans, but it's fairly common. It occurs commonly during sleep, and the period of time when the person stops breathing is called apnea or sleep apnea. It's more likely to occur when carbon dioxide concentration in the blood is low, hypocapnia, and this can be induced, for example, by high altitude. It's much more common among mountain climbers or people who move to a higher altitude. Hyperventilation, alkalosis, all conditions that can lead to Chain-Stokes respiration, cardiac disease during which the blood flow rate is impaired, and brain or neurological damage that can affect the feedback loop. There was an interesting experiment done by Guyton, who is the author of that textbook I just quoted. A long time ago, half a century ago, he did experiments on a dog in which he took inserted a shunt between the heart and the brain of the dog, so the artery, the blood, instead of flowing through the artery, had to take a long route, and so he effectively increased the delay in the circulation from the heart to the brain, and invariably that caused Chain-Stokes respiration in the dog. So it was pretty clear that this time delay played an important role, and again in the 70s, Mackey and Glass published a paper on Chain-Stokes respiration, where they published this now famous delay equation, the Mackey-Glass equation, which is simply a single scalar equation where X is the CO2 concentration, and the subscript tau in the usual notation of delay equations means that that function is being evaluated at an earlier time, a time-delayed function. This nonlinear quantity here in the square brackets, I'll come back to in a minute. They found that if you increased the time delay or increased the gain mu beyond this constant here, then this gave rise to oscillations which resembled the kind of oscillations one observes in Chain-Stokes respiration. The function in the square brackets there is the so-called Hill function, which is plotted here. People use all kinds of mathematical functions to represent a biological switch or step function, something that is low then rapidly increases to a higher value, and this is scaled to go from 0 to 1. Of course, biological switches never go directly, discontinuously, from 0 to 1. And by varying, so if you think about that function, it has this kind of graph. As you increase the exponent n here, it gets steeper and steeper. Here you see the cases n equals 5 and n equals 10. It approaches a step function as n goes to infinity. And the idea is that this is how your control system works. It's like kind of like a thermostat in the house. When CO2 is too low, it turns off the breathing to let it come up, and vice versa. The gain I define to be simply the maximum slope right here. So it's the ratio of change in input carbon dioxide concentration in the arteries to the change in output, which would be is eventually the breathing rate. The steepest part here, the gain, is just the derivative of that function. Turns out to be, in this case, to be n over 4. So it's directly proportional to the exponent n up there, and it makes this a very convenient function to model such things. Okay, so that was this historically important Glass-Mackey model, and Julie was, my student, was interested in doing some mathematical biology, and we said, well, maybe we can take, add a little more physiology and see what more we can learn about chain Stokes respiration. So here is, again, from a medical textbook, the circulatory system, representing the heart, of course, the pump in the middle, the lungs and the pulmonary circulation through the lungs back to the heart, and then the circulatory system labeled A up here. This would be flowing to the brain and the rest of the body. Red, of course, is arterial blood, rich in oxygen. Blue is the venous blood coming back low in oxygen, high in CO2. The model we put together is very similar to that, but we just use compartments for each of those components of that picture. So here's a compartment that represents the blood in the pulmonary veins, the systemic arteries. Systemic veins, pulmonary arteries. One compartment here for the blood going through the capillaries, where the exchange, of course, oxygen, CO2 takes place. Another one here for the blood in the pulmonary capillaries, where the reverse exchange takes place. So that's six compartments, and a seventh up here, which is different from the others. It's not blood, but it's the air in the lungs, the alveoli, which are the little sacs where the exchange takes place in the lungs, because eventually the carbon dioxide is exchanged with the atmosphere. So with those seven compartments, we took data from the literature. There is in a typical adult human, there's about 5 liters of blood in the system, and it's divided up among these various compartments like this. So these are the volumes in each of the six compartments. The corresponding X's would be the carbon dioxide concentration in each of the compartments. The seventh compartment, the lung, has concentration X7, but in different units, partial pressure, which is convenient for atmospheric CO2. And this is, of course, the volume of air in the lungs, whereas those are volumes of blood. Important simplification that we made on reading the literature is that we model only the carbon dioxide and ignore O2, and naively you would think oxygen is more important to model. But the brain, the sensors, do not respond to oxygen deficiency. They respond to carbon dioxide excess, which is just a trick of evolution, I guess, and it's easier to measure CO2. So our model ignores O2, and the body assumes, somewhat incorrectly, as in the case of carbon monoxide poisoning, of course, the body assumes that high CO2 means low O2 and vice versa. So the rest of the model, of course, has to take into account what's going on in the lungs. Chain Stokes respiration is a respiratory phenomenon. And here's a nice picture of the lungs. We simplify that, of course, to a compartment. And we need to model I missed the transparency. Yes. Let me show this one first before we get to to the lungs for the six blood compartments. Our equations are very simple compartmental analysis, simply that the rate of the change of carbon dioxide in compartment K is the volume times the rate of change of concentration. That gives you the total rate of change of carbon dioxide in that compartment. It's equal to the flow rate. F is the blood flow rate, which is assumed to be constant around the body. No leakage. Times the concentration in minus out. So flow in minus flow out equals the rate of change in the compartment. And these are linear, as they must be. This is not a simplifying assumption of linearity. This is just conservation of carbon dioxide as it goes through the system. Of course, the arteries and veins, which are these two and these two, don't produce or destroy carbon dioxide. But in the capillaries, carbon dioxide is produced in the body and absorbed in the capillary, so the amount of carbon dioxide here is increased also, not only by what flows in and out in the circulatory system, but also what's being produced. P dot is the rate of production of carbon dioxide by metabolism, and it's in this range. And R dot is negative, so that's the rate at which carbon dioxide is being removed through the cell walls in the alveoli in the lungs. Okay, so now back to the lungs and the respiratory system. We need to think a little bit more about this, what this R dot is. This is standard notation in the literature that we found in respiration. R dot, P dot, F dot, and so on, being time rate of change, not necessarily a derivative, because these are usually assumed to be constants, but they are like derivatives. So these are the assumptions that are made. There's a nice book of West, for example, called Respiratory Physiology, on how the blood transfers carbon dioxide to the air in the alveoli. And so we use fairly standard assumptions that the rate of change is proportional to the rate at which blood is delivering carbon dioxide, the blood flow rate, F dot, and the difference in concentrations of carbon dioxide on the two sides. Right? The more the difference is, the more gets transferred. And there are various constants, which one can work out, proportionality constants. Furthermore, as I said, we're using different measures of concentration in air and blood for the carbon dioxide, so there's a conversion that has to be made there. Which I don't need to go into details. Once the carbon dioxide is in to the, makes its transfer from blood to lungs, then it has to be exhaled, right? It's not out of the body yet. It's removed, of course, by breathing. And more breathing speeds up the rate of expiration of carbon dioxide. So if V dot is the ventilation rate, which is the rate at which air is exchanged with the outside, in other words, breaths per minute times volumes per breath, all of which can be easily quantified. And V sub A is the volume of the alveoli in the lungs where the exchange took place, partial pressure, and so on, a proportionality constant. Then you arrive at an equation like this. For the rate of change of the carbon dioxide in the seventh compartment, the lungs, is this one, which is the removal of carbon dioxide through breathing, and plus this term, which is the input of carbon dioxide from the blood through this diffusion across the cell walls. All right, so we are finished constructing our model except for one important component, and this is the feedback control system. As I said, there is a chemosensitive area in the brain which monitors CO2, and I'm not going to worry about how that actually works, but what it does is monitor whether the CO2 concentration too high or too low, and then via that Hill function send a signal to the lungs saying breathe more or less. Okay, I'm going to make the same assumption as Mackie and Glass and use this Hill function. So this is the key assumption for the feedback loop, that the ventilation rate in the lungs, which is breathing times volume air per breath, is some constant, V dot with a bar over it, times and they scale it to be twice this Hill function, because of course it goes from 0 to 1. It's sort of normal value is a half, so this just means this is equal to 1 when x2 equals a, right? Set x2 equal a, and this is just a half. A is the normal value, whatever that would be under normal conditions. And the gain, as I said before, can easily be calculated as the derivative of this at x equals a, which is n over 4 a, or n over 4 of a scaled to be 1. With all of that, then, I can summarize. Here is the mathematical model of 7 equations. It's mostly linear. The nonlinearity is in the feedback control, which is highly nonlinear. Now, a slight digression. I want to introduce you to, if you haven't already heard about it, the ventilation perfusion ratio. Impressive sounding term, but all it means is the ratio of two quantities, which I've already introduced. The ratio of this ventilation rate, V dot, with or without the bar, bar is not important, to the blood flow rate, F dot. Okay, the ratio at which carbon dioxide is exhaled from the body through ventilation from the lungs to the air, to the flow rate, blood flow rate, which is the rate at which it's being brought to the lungs by the circulatory system. This ratio appears quite often in the literature on respiration, the ventilation perfusion ratio. It plays a very important role in proper operation of the respiratory system. For example, suppose this ratio is increased. Okay, suppose you increase your breathing rate, just start breathing faster. Your blood, your heart doesn't change, so the blood flow rate is constant. Well, then carbon dioxide will be removed from the lungs faster than it's being delivered by the blood. So the concentration will drop in the lungs. So it will then, because of this very efficient diffusion of carbon dioxide from the blood into the lungs, concentration in the blood will drop as it's leaving the lungs. It will be carried to the brain. And the entire body, in fact, the concentration of carbon dioxide in your whole body will drop. Then the brain, on sensing that, will send feedback control signal to the lungs saying the CO2 is lower than necessary. Don't breathe so hard. You'll reduce the ventilation rate, bringing the ratio back to a lower value. So that's sort of the understanding of how the system works and how the model works, is what the model is trying to represent. So now we do a mathematical analysis of these equations with parameter values drawn from the physiology literature. There is a unique equilibrium state for reasonable values of the parameters. You can linearize the system about that equilibrium and get a 7x7 Jacobian matrix. It has 7 eigenvalues. These eigenvalues normally have negative real part, so the equilibrium is stable. However, if you play with the parameters in the model, you can make those eigenvalues move, and you can cause a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues increase in real part and cross the imaginary axis. You can accomplish that in several ways. You can increase the feedback control gain, that is the steepness of the Hill function, which means the feedback loop is a stronger response. You can increase the ventilation rate, or you can decrease the blood flow rate, the heart rate, if you like. Any of those can lead to complex eigenvalues crossing the imaginary axis. For dynamical systems people know that means a hot bifurcation, so you expect a limit cycle, which can be stable or unstable, depending on further calculations which can be done. And which Julie did in her thesis, and it turns out it's always a stable limit cycle. So this indeed seems to provide a mechanism for the onset of Chain-Stokes, this oscillation in breathing. So that's what we were looking for, and then beyond that, of course, you want to know, does this tell us anything you didn't already know? Right, we already knew there was Chain-Stokes respiration, so having a model that reproduces it isn't a big deal. One thing we realized, and this is the reason for the digression a moment ago, is that just by chance, I mean, it was not intended, But this mathematical model, if you non-dimensionalize, as good mathematicians always like to do, you find these separate parameters disappear, and only the ratio is important of these two parameters. And this ratio is precisely the ventilation perfusion ratio that is emphasized in the experimental literature as being important in respiration. So that was kind of a nice surprise for us to realize that our model is saying that it's this ventilation perfusion ratio is very important for chain strokes respiration. Only the ratio affects the hot bifurcation. And that I hadn't seen before. I don't know if anyone in the audience has seen that connection. I know other people have worked on chain strokes respiration, and so they might have found that too, but I'd be interested in hearing about that. So here's the result of a great deal of numerical analysis on these equations. A neutral stability curve. This curve here joined, well, fitted by cubic lines to the dots which were computed. These dots are where, and this curve approximately, is where these complex eigenvalues cross the imaginary axis. So the equilibrium is going from stable to unstable, and a limit cycle is being born as you cross. On this side, the equilibrium is stable, no chain strokes. On the other side, the equilibrium is unstable, but the limit cycle has been created and is stable, so you get this oscillation, all right? So crossing this curve in our model corresponds to creating chain strokes oscillation. Notice you can cross it either by increasing the gain here in the feedback loop, making the feedback, you know, stronger, or you can increase the ventilation perfusion ratio, this ratio of ventilation to blood flow, this cross this way. Either of those, or some combination of the two, causes onset of what is chain strokes respiration in our model. So that we thought was interesting. If we go to where the oscillations are predicted, that is above that curve on the side of the limit cycle, and look at the various variables, we have just taking two of them here. Let's see. Y7, remember the seventh compartment is the air in the lungs. Y2 is the compartment, the blood that's reaching the brain. Okay, so if you compare carbon dioxide oscillations in the lungs and in the brain, of course these are different units, so you can't really compare, right? This is partial pressure in millimeters of mercury, and this is concentration in volume units. So the relative amplitudes aren't really important here, but the phase difference is important, and it's exactly the phase difference I showed you way back on the first or second slide of from the textbook. They're shifted, as you can see, in just the right way. Sorry. Now they're shifted the right way. So the model works as far as the phase relationships is concerned. Another thing we read in the literature that physicians have found that if someone with chain strokes respiration is given a heightened level of carbon dioxide in the air, they wear a mask perhaps, that gives a little extra carbon dioxide in the air that they're breathing, it goes away. It's a little bit counterintuitive at first, but extra carbon dioxide cures chain strokes respiration. So we took our model, increased the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is one of the parameters in our model, increased it just from 0.3 to 5. Well, that's a fairly big increase, but it's still very low concentration, not unlike what's in the atmosphere. This is the original curve I showed you before. This is the new curve with higher CO2 in the atmosphere. In other words, if you were sitting right here physiologically and the atmosphere changed from this curve to that curve, your chain strokes respiration would go away. So now you're above the curve, but once the curve moves there, you're below the curve. It would disappear. So that confirms those experiments. Okay, I'm trying to finish on time, and I guess I've succeeded in rushing. I've left out, of course, the mathematical details of the calculation. If you know how to do Hopf bifurcation theory, I wouldn't be telling you anything new, and if you don't know, then I wouldn't have time to do it properly in the time available, so I've left that out. So let me just go over what we've learned from this model and some suggestions for future work for my next student, we showed that increasing the gain or this ventilation perfusion ratio are both equally effective in increasing the chance, bring on the onset of chain strokes, respiration like oscillations. The model seems to agree with physiological and medical observations in all these areas. If you sleep apnea, well, while you're sleeping, your blood flow rate decreases, so that would increase the ratio. Hyperventilation means you're breathing faster. Obviously, that increases the ratio. High altitude, at high altitude, because of the lower oxygen, you have to work harder, breathe harder, and your ventilation rate goes up, so your carbon dioxide concentration goes down. Cardiac damage means your blood flow is decreased. Neural disorders could decrease your reaction time and gain in the neurological system, and so on. So the model is doing reasonably well, but it's still not perfect. One major disappointment was that although we get these curves at which oscillation appears when you cross them, the gain is unrealistically high. These are big numbers in here on the gain axis. We'd like to have them much lower than that. Another problem in the model is it predicts a period of oscillation of 25 seconds, but in humans it's about a minute. So our period is half what it should be. It's too oscillating too fast. And another unrelated issue is that this is a stiff system of ordinary differential equations. We had some numerical instabilities due to the stiffness of the equations, due to the fact that the compartments have very low volumes. Remember, the equation had volume times derivative. If that volume is very small, you have a stiff equation. So that's a technical issue. And I think John Milton has left, but John will be waving his hand about now, I would think. Maybe Jacques, do you want to be John Milton? Where are the delays? Okay. The model doesn't explicitly include a delay, as in Mike's talk and John Milton's talk. Delays are important, and so I have to address that question. What happened to the time delays? Well, number one, this was a master's thesis, and in order for a student to finish within the allotted time, we decided to avoid time delays and work with ODEs rather than delay equations, because the student had never studied delay equations. Number two, when you have compartmental model, there is a natural built-in delay as the blood goes from compartment to compartment to compartment, right? A change here isn't instantly felt down here. It has the carbon dioxide builds up here, and then it starts to build up in the next one. So the compartments take care of the delays. Number three, in fact, that's how the system works. The brain is not responding to, literally, to blood that left the lungs a few seconds ago. It's responding to the blood that's in the brain right now. It just took some transport time for the blood to get there. So in a way, this may be heresy, but delays are a bit of a mathematical fiction introduced for convenience to reduce the number of equations. To actually model what happens from here to here would involve more equations. So it's a trade-off whether you want, the extreme case is the Mackey-Glass model, which is one equation where the delay does it all. Here we've got seven equations without a delay. We could improve the model, though, because when you look at our model in terms of delay, the delay is not what it should be, because we only have a small number of compartments. That's why I put this up. This is also from the physiological literature describing, this is what I showed you before, this is another sort of a model, and it says you can think of the circulation as blood goes from the heart to the aorta, which is this thick vein, artery, up here, from there to the arteries, which would be this part, and there to the arterioles, and then finally to the capillary. In other words, what we treated as one big compartment maybe should be three or more, and if you do that, that's going to add to the delay time and we'll fix this problem of the missing delays. You could go all the way and make it become a fluid dynamicist and use real fluid transport, PDEs. But that's The first suggestion for future work is to more realistically model. Here is the suggestion for my next student, for Fang Dong, to separate the arteries into three components, which will then build in this delay more realistically. And you can easily see that will have the effect of improving the accuracy of both the period of the oscillation and the gain required to cause isolations. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you.